work. It'll be mid-June. It's a Brooklyn location, and you will love the experience. Or you can be very generous and pledge for the whole lot of it. All right, we're going to go to Beauty by Virgo. Good night. Good morning, Paulette.
Good night. Good morning, Kathy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
The face of beauty appears in every step, every sunrise, every ray of sunlight that kisses my skin. The face of beauty appears in every step, every sunrise, every ray of sunlight that kisses my skin.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and stuff like that. When we are here, and we are with Richard Bowes, who will be reading for us, and we have to catch up on two movie reviews. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The high-level takeaway from Mad Max Fury Road, I guess, is that director George Miller treats it as if nothing has happened in film between the end of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome and now. But something did happen, and that something is a franchise called Fast and Furious. After watching Universal harvest a heap of money for relatively little outlay, somebody at Warner's maybe or Village Roadshow maybe said, hey, we've got a franchise with insane car stunts too. In fact, Mad Max, the franchise, kind of defined insane car chase movies, at least for the American market. They were doing it in Australia for a while before that anyway. In any case, 30 years hence, here comes Max again in the person of Tom Hardy this time, since Mel Gibson is otherwise unoccupied, either voluntarily or not. And I have to admit, watching this film reawakened my concerns about maybe having become too jaded about summer movies. A lot has been made of Mad Max Fury Road and its use of practical stunts over CG. There is a lot of CG in the film anyway, because there needs to be. But it's also clear there are a lot of real people piloting and contending with real rolling hardware in there. And there's also been a lot of celebration for how Fury Road is stripping the summer action film down to its purest form. Yes, it is essentially a two-hour-long chase sequence with Max joining forces with Charlize Theron's Imperator Furiosa, lots of colorfully named characters in this film, to help a group of runaway brides escape their imprisonment from a brutal warlord. You gotta respect the effort, at least. It is a kind of pure cinema, pure kinetics. There are problems with it, though, one of which is when you're starting at that accelerated energy level, the risk of overload becomes very real. No matter how insane you make your mise-en-scene, and George Miller is no stranger to plenty insane, Fury Road overflows with colorfully grotesque characters, including hordes of whitewashed slaves, scarified warriors, a clutch of bounteous milk mothers, Master Sands Blaster, and a giant rolling heavy metal war band, and that's just the first half hour there. Throwing all of that in, you fast get to the point of, okay, I get it. What else have you got? I sat there soaking it all in and being, ironically for so car-centric a movie, completely unmoved. Doesn't help that Tom Hardy doesn't project much charisma as the new Max. However you feel about Gibson as a person, you have to admit he has something as a screen presence that isn't easily replicated. And this is not particularly Max's film anyway. Miller seems more fascinated by Theron and her band of comely escapees, with Max along for the ride because somebody possibly thought you couldn't sell a film called Mad Maxine. It's too bad, because the real fun comes from watching Theron with a robotic prosthetic arm and company being all hardcore with bad guys. Even one of the bad guys, Nux, played by Nicholas Holt, is a more fascinating character to spend time with than the guy with his name on the title. That's not good. So, Mad Max Fury Road is big and loud and very inventive in its visuals and its characters and its action. I can't deny that. And it left me sitting there straining to wrest some enjoyment out of it. I didn't get there. There is something to be said for George Miller bringing back the crazy intensity of classic Australian action film. There's nothing like it in the world still. And for all that this didn't work for me, I'm hoping we'll see more. So, good there. I'm on board with that. I'm even eager to see what Miller does next. Just next time, I hope there's less obsession with pushing the boundaries. As Spinal Tap demonstrated, turning it up to 11 in and of itself doesn't necessarily serve much purpose. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my My Team Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to My Team Movie Podcast. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. You don't particularly expect a summer film to contain a critical analysis of a theme park. You also don't expect that analysis to turn into a critique of us as a culture in general. But that's what the Disney Company's Tomorrowland wants to be. And while the goal itself is noble, the journey to that finish line raises some questions. There's this girl, you see, Casey Newton, played by Britt Robertson with appealing earnestness, who despite the predictions of doom fed her through the media, through school, through popular culture, through basically everywhere, still believes in the potential of humanity and of the future. And she gets confirmation of her optimism through a mysterious pin that, when touched, conjures the image of Tomorrowland, a towering metropolis whose steel spires contain a society filled with jetpacks, anti-grav baby carriages, commuter runs to other worlds, in sleek cigar-shaped spaceships, of course, etc. So seductive is this vision that Casey is compelled to seek Tomorrowland out, enlisting in her search a young and benevolent android, actually described as an audio animatronic for those of you schooled in Disney technology, played with eerie maturity by Raffi Cassidy, and a renegade scientist played by George Clooney, who, it turns out, is an exile from the real Tomorrowland, by which I mean the real film Tomorrowland, which here exists in an alternate dimension that isn't explained in any satisfactory way. And here's the trap that director Brad Bird and his co-writing partner Damon Lindelof have built for themselves. The real Tomorrowland, the theme park one, that they invoke is the one that existed at the original Disneyland and briefly as an outpost at the New York World's Fair in 1964 and 65, which, by the way, when it shows up at the beginning of the film, had me tearing up. I'll admit it. It was that formative an event in my life. The theme park Tomorrowland that the film cites existed from mid-50s about to some point in the 80s and was very much a reflection of Walt Disney's sincere optimism for the future, a time he envisioned as one where technology, courtesy of such benefactors as General Electric, Ford, and Monsanto, would build a world of peace and prosperity. But that was an impossible future, built on the false notion of the benevolent corporation. It was something Disney believed in. It couldn't be so. Bird and Lindelof do acknowledge this in the film's final act, set in a decaying Tomorrowland, although in the film's telling, the fall is due to a surfeit of bad vibes, rather than the inability of an impossible dream to survive in the face of hard reality. Tomorrowland, the film, wants to awaken in us the kind of society that regards the future with optimism. But the film chooses as its example a discredited vision of that future, ignoring that the provenance for that vision was hardly a period of halcyon bliss. Not if you were African American, not if you were Vietnamese, or suspected of being a commie. At best, that willful ignorance is counterproductive. At worst, it's downright reactionary, although I seriously doubt the latter was Bird's and Lindelof's intent. As sincere as Tomorrowland's goals are, it's hard for anyone above the age of 10 to embrace them wholeheartedly. And perhaps the film's best audience are those young enough to uncritically embrace its outlook. It doesn't help that the scenario is full of wonderful imagery and fantastic action sequences. Bird, if you haven't figured it out by now, remains a fantastic visionary, but doesn't hang together as a coherent narrative. Too much happens and too many characters exist just for the thrill of the moment. Trying to understand their purpose in a larger context will only lead to confusion. It's a bunch of dazzling, fun stuff in support of a spurious notion, capped off by a resolution so blatant in its metaphor that the experience is kind of like being shaken by the lapels while someone screams, "Be optimistic!" into your face. But, spurious notion though it is a lovely spurious notion. If you get the sense that I'm splitting my opinion here, it's because I am. Look, I used to write about Disney theme parks for one of the Disney magazines, so I've visited them enough to know that they put a lot of stock into certain words, words like imagination or magic. Those words get invoked so often everywhere that for all the Disney franchises that get shoved down your throat while you're at a Disney park, your main takeaway from a visit may be a line spoken by Inigo Montoya in The Princess Bride. You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. But then, at least the concepts being hawked are good ones. Tomorrowland does the same thing with the concept of optimism, divorcing it from any context that it would need in reality to truly work. The film, for all its science fiction trappings, wanders too often into the realm of magical thinking to be healthy. But then, what a nice thing to think about, looking forward to the future and then using that optimism as the engine to drive its realization. And maybe we need to leave it at that. It's a very expensive film intent upon profound change via what turns out to be a humble goal, convincing us to look forward to the future. I was entranced by Tomorrowland. For all its flaws in its arguments and its plotting, its idealism is palpable and beguiling. That our route to an idyllic future will take more work than the film is willing to consider is maybe not something for which we should hold Bird, Lindelof, or a whole corps of Imagineers accountable. For 2 hours, we can dream the dream. We just can't accept that that's enough to make it so. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website. So check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Okay, well, thank you, Dan, and thank you, everybody. This is like, you know, makeshift home studio here, folks. It is absolutely...
It does look like somebody's cellar.
It does, doesn't it? Except it's the third
it's
floor.
It's a refinished cellar.
Yeah, I mean, it's the cellar of this place that is absolutely, utterly magnificent. Well, actually, that's not the cellar. There is a cellar. It's the first floor, the cafe of this building that we are in at the Brooklyn Commons. But each time that Hour of the Wolf has changed venue, my first guest has always been Richard Bowes.
It is my fate.
It is, because, you know, and I've always said this, and it was proven again, you know, how Bill Murray, you know, is, you know, Letterman's go-to guy. So you're my Bill Murray, Rick.
I feel awful.
However, having said that, in this facility, you actually have to get very close to the mic.
Oh, should I put it like this? Oh.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's much better.
It's not like that other, not like that being down in the cellar.
Yeah, no, here you really have to, I think the technical term is fillet the microphone.
Really?
In order to be heard on the air.
It fills me with no such desire.
Well, you haven't met Mike, but anyway, this is WBAI in New York City.
One of the things we don't have here.
It's
is the 10 words. Well, we don't have many things, but we don't have the 10 words.
Seven
words. Only seven words.
Carlin only ever said seven words.
Okay.
And they are.
Yes, I. Well, the thing that was very strange.
And.
The thing that was strange is in the other WBAIs. Was that the words you weren't supposed to say
were right
in front of you at all times. Yes.
Yes.
And the only thing you could really think of was those words you weren't supposed to say.
Exactly. Yeah, we had a fellow, I can't even tell the joke, but, you know, I'll say snort in place of the dirty word. And so he said, well, I've had enough of this bleep snort. And he just did it exactly the wrong way around. And that was Gary Freed, for those people that remember.
Who can remember, yes.
Yes.
But yes, that was, I won't say it was the oddest thing about WBAI.
Hardly.
No, but
hardly.
It certainly was odd.
And also, by the way, inaccurate.
Yes, that was the other part of it. I was so disappointed.
Yeah, it really is, because it's not about the words. It never was. That list of words belonged to George Carlin.
Yes.
It's not, the FCC has a much dimmer view than those words. They have only one word that you can't invoke.
And what is that word?
Indecency.
Indecency.
You are not allowed to do indecency at a time. Now, this is a very important time.
When children
might be listening. The Supreme Court, the FCC mandated the indecency part, and the Supreme Court modified that to the when children were around. And the reason why Justice Department of the United States versus Pacifica Radio, otherwise known as the Carlin decision, went against Pacifica Radio, that's to say us, was because the time of the broadcast of Carlin's routines, the seven words you can't say on television, was a Saturday afternoon at 2. And between you, me, and the lamppost, I happen to agree with the Supreme Court's decision that it was reckless to play that at 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon.
You think there were children listening to WBAI at that moment?
I think there were children broadcasting at that time. I started listening to WBAI for what they had, PYP, Programs for Young People. Something we don't do much of anymore.
Or at all anymore.
At all. Yeah, yes. We don't have any kind of a kids' show. Something that anybody in management listening, something I would like to change. I did a kids' show here called Kinder Fantasy Geschichten.
Right.
That's one word.
For the German child. Yes.
Yes, and I'm sure that you can translate that.
Absolutely not, no.
Yeah, children's fantasy stories.
Ah.
Kinder, Fantasy, Geschichten, stories.
Right. There's only one word.
But that's one word.
There's only one word in German, but it goes on for days.
Yeah, well, yes, there is that. But Kinder Fantasy Geschichten was a good one. And for the opening credits, I had a 5-year-old say the word Kinder Fantasy Geschichten. And I thought that was, like, you know, a good way to do it. And then for an hour on Saturday mornings, we had just readings of stories, mostly fantasy stories.
Right, I remember
stories.
That, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of fun with that. Did a lot of Sheckley some Frederick Brown.
Probably seems fit for children, but that's all right.
Ghost 5 by Sheckley.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that you
One
know
forgets,
that.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, no. The digest stories of the 1950s were very appropriate for... Those were the stories that I was... cutting my teeth on.
Well, at that point, science fiction was basically for kids. And that was one of the big difficulties. And
kids and puppies, yes.
Right, in the 60s when it began to change. And suddenly, you know, librarians in grammar school libraries around the United States discovered...
Not universities?
Universities, yeah. No, not particularly.
Because you were, of course, at NYU in the library
department. I was at NYU in the library, but, for instance, we didn't have any science fiction magazines. There were no speculative fiction magazines.
Really? Actually, I'm surprised by that.
If you knew what it was like, nothing would surprise you after you had been there. But, no, the only one, what was the one Ellen... was the fiction editor for...
Omni.
We did have Omni. And Omni led this very strange existence because sometimes...
We should tell listeners that's Ellen Datlow we're referring to.
Ellen Datlow is the Ellen in question, yes. Sometimes
Who
Omni...
Who the Ellen is Datlow?
Yes. Sometimes Omni would be upstairs in the science library, and other times it would be downstairs in the general reading
And she had replaced, in fact, the aforementioned
Mr. Sheckley.
That's right, Robert Sheckley, whose daughter, Alyssa Quitney,
yes,
has just put out the first issue of which DC character? Genevieve Valentine is doing Catwoman. And Alyssa just began another DC comic character just launched, Supergirl, but some other similar kind of a thing. I'd love to get the two of them together.
Lia Don Johnson at one point was going to do one.
She was, yeah. I forgot which.
But yes, I guess going off to Mexico put an end to that.
But it shouldn't. I mean, there's no reason why people can't do... Well, I guess they need to be near their artists, don't they?
They need to be near their artists,
But you can collaborate online for all this stuff. I think Genevieve Valentine does.
She does. Anyway, yes, that... yes, now there are...
But anyway.
Yeah.
So, could, if that clock is correct, could a WBAI clock be correct? Yes, it could. So it's already nearing 2 o'clock, and we ought to get started, because your story is about 40 minutes long, right?
I believe it is. I'll read very quickly.
Yeah, I'd rather you didn't.
I'm going to read very quickly, yes, and get through this.
Okay, but before you do that, let me take until 2 o'clock, that's 2 minutes from now, to tell people that Hour of the Wolf has been on WBAI in one form or another. This is the 6th building that I have worked at, the 5th building in which Hour of the Wolf has existed, and this room we are in is just that. It is a room. It does not have walls that reach the ceiling. It's 3/4.
It's an unfinished basement.
It's an unfinished third floor is right. What it is. And from this fundraising drive that we are in, we hope to turn the room that we are in into a studio. It is right now... just a, sort of a makeshift. If a bus goes down Atlantic Avenue, you, the listener, will share in the joy of hearing that bus. You will not just hear Lister come into the studio. You will hear him downstairs ring the buzzer and the whole thing. This particular fundraising drive is not just, hey, help us, or we're going to go off the air, because we're going off the air all the time. The phone lines from here are sketchy. This is, help us, or we're not even going to have a, we don't have a studio. We need a studio. And that is the big priority for this fundraising drive.
The seven-year plan.
This room is going to cost about $25,000, I have heard. And that seems like conservative, if there's anything at BAI that's conservative estimate. So we ask you to call. We demand you call area code 212-209-2950 and make a pledge, or go to WBAI.org. Yes, I know it should probably be org, but in fact it's org, O-R-G. And you will see a link there that will let you pledge. And it asks you in the name of what show you are pledging. And the answer is, of course, Hour of the Wolf. But it is overall for WBAI in general. So what do you think of the room, Rick?
I think it's a beautiful thing and should not be touched in any way.
Yeah, you would. How would you compare this to the CCNY? I mean, you actually liked it there.
CCNY was an actual studio.
It was a semi-studio. It was actually a mixing room.
Right, but it looked to me, who knows nothing about this, like a studio.
Yeah.
This, on the other hand, reminds me of when I was a kid, and it's like one of my friends.
It's like one of those playhouses.
it's more like the semi-finished basement in one of your friends' houses. You know, and the father had high plans for fixing the thing up, but, you know, then he decided he liked drinking more, so he never finished it, and that's what this looks like. But, on the other hand, I mean, that place downtown you were in wasn't all that stupendous looking either. I mean, you know.
120 Wall?
120 Wall.
Yeah, but it worked. It was soundproof.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I remember on September 11th, 2011, on the 10th anniversary, you were on the air at 11 a.m. with There's a Hole in the City.
Right.
And when we walked in...
Oops.
We weren't on the air. But amazingly, one minute before our appointed hour, and we had quite a time getting in there.
Yep.
Because the cops were really not helpful approaching the district.
We certainly looked suspicious.
Well, I always do.
Yeah.
So we were having the same kind of technical difficulties. But, you see, that had studios. I could have a band in the next room and a reader in another room, and I could mix them together. And the room that we were in was actually soundproofed.
That's right. Unless you left the door open, you couldn't hear what was happening outside, and no one outside could make noise that transferred into the room.
Yes, whereas here we actually do get the traffic from Atlantic Avenue. So, but I have to say, I love this neighborhood.
It's a beautiful neighborhood. Yes.
It really is nice. Yeah. And I am moving the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings to this same building, having nothing to do with WBAI other than we have the same landlord. And she's really cool. And so she has converted the first floor into this cafe with... Oh, and I do need to mention this. If anybody wants to see the readings that we had three readings basically to close out April and start May. And if you want to see what it looks like when this show is over, when Lister's show is over, go to livestream.com and search for NYRSF, which is the name of the reading series, New York Review of Science Fiction readings. NYRSF is actually the magazine the reading series is named after. But just NYRSF, and you will see three readings. One with Samuel R. Delaney and Sam J. Miller. That's the two Sams. Then one with Rob Sherman, who wrote the TV episode Dalek for Doctor Who, and is a fine horror writer. I was introduced to him through Ellen Datlow. And he wrote this wonderful story about Snoopy being dead. It was, I thought it was hilarious and charming. And then after that, we had Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison, along with Cherie Renee Thomas. And the first event with Delaney and Miller, we had like 100 people, just shy of 100 people there. And the camera work, the three robotic cameras. Now, there's a problem with the mics. There's a buzz, a loud buzz. But that's been solved. Terrence Taylor, the now official technical director of the New York Review of Science Fiction reading series, because he walked in there, saw a little TV studio.
And fell in love.
The word that came out of his mouth was, "Candy!" And he just walked in there. Nobody had really used it before. They said, okay, we can try one camera. And Terrence created a professional TV show. And if people go to livestream.com and take a look, you will see the future of that reading series. And you will see what 388 Atlantic Avenue looks like. Because it's in that cafe down there. It's spiffy.
It is. It's a nice room.
It is. So, 212-209-2950 to call and pledge. Richard, you have a specific story.
I do. I have it, and if they don't pledge, I'm going to go on reading.
I have no idea to find out if they're pledging or not. I assume we're getting millions right now.
I think we are. Not millions of dollars, mind you, but millions. Yes, I have a story. It's called Fordham Court. And it's...
It sounds strangely New Yorkish for a story that I'm sure is going to be set in Boston.
Boston. It's going to be set in Boston, yeah. Should I start?
Yes.
Okay.
Forgive me if I wander. I will, A, take a couple of photographs. B, look around. I hardly know this facility here. And C, make sure that Lister is going to get into the room okay. I will advise, for the reading of the story, pull Mike, your friend Mike there, closer to you.
Mike is as close to me.
Oh, that's excellent.
Mike is as close to me as he can get. Okay. The story is Fordham Court. To evoke the first place I lived, I try to remember the first adult words I understood. The scrambled way toys and furniture were as important as people. The terrors that came with the dark. Those things stay with you. Like the tattered visions, the legends without context, born by a wanderer returned from a land of giants and twisted magic. I am that wanderer, many decades away from childhood, and trying to arrange memories in what seems a coherent order. I do this knowing that certain memories defy rational order. I remember eyes staring into mine from the bottom of a pond, and women sitting in my mother's kitchen playing solitaire with photographs. Looking to bridge the gaps between my current old age and the post-war 1940s, I dig out fragments of plays, stories with tattered endings. The ones who wrote them, my mother at age 35, me at 22, are themselves remote mysteries. We lived, when I was small, in a horseshoe-shaped apartment house the locals called Fordham Court. Just recently, I learned that Fordham Court, looking bright and spiffy, stands to this day on South Street in Jamaica Plain in Boston. Boston stories usually devolve into baseball. Long before my time, the building was owned by the man who owned the then successful Boston Red Sox and who had originally hired Babe Ruth. It wasn't he who sold the Babe to New York, but maybe the place had a touch of a curse or magic when I first lived there and when I may last have visited it. My earliest memories are of my mother. In the first coherent one, I'm maybe two, and sitting on what I believe is her dressing table, with a woman who was familiar to me, though now I can't remember who she is. The door opens, and my mother, Kay, enters her dressing room in Portia's court costume from The Merchant of Venice. She was an actress back then. My father, John, too, was connected to the theater, and so were all their friends. None of them had children. I was a novelty and pet, sat on laps, said the enigmatic things small children say. One winter night, with company present, my mother remembered the wash on the line up on the roof. She and a friend went up with a basket, came back with sheets and clothes, stiff as boards. This included a pair of my pajamas, ones with feet. They leaned them up against the wall, and, without a cue, I shook a frozen sleeve like that was its hand and won wild applause. Going down the center aisle of the church one Sunday, I saw packed pews, turned, saw the choir crammed into the loft, and said in the clear voice of childhood, "It's a full house." Once I was using a windowsill as a stage. The curtains as theater curtains. Empty glasses served as actors. I opened the curtains and moved a bottle of beer from the wings to center stage. Someone said, "John Barrymore, to the very life of him. The boy has the makings of a director." And everyone laughed and hugged me. But by then I was five, going on to kindergarten, and had at least an inkling of what I was doing. It's the time of my unreason that haunts me, the time before I was as human as I've managed to get. Men were around. My father was back from the war. But as a kid, I lived largely in a world of Irish and Irish-American women. I scarcely knew anyone else. Mom, my father's mother, lived with us, so old and white-haired that I confused her image with that of George Washington. She was born in the late 1870s in the Fall River of Lizzie Borden, the home of the textile mills. Mom had started working in the mills at the age of 10 and never quite grasped the world in which she found herself. It was her belief that both parties in a telephone conversation had to hang up at the same moment or risk an electric shock. "I'm hanging up at my end," she would say. "Best hang up on yours." Lots of my instinctive reactions I can trace to these years. Mom was a bleeder, from her nose mostly, but also her fingertips. Once a needle, probably from the old mills, all rusty and bloody from wandering her system for decades, came poking out from the end of an index finger. I don't wince at the sight of blood, except my own. Once, my mother and her two sisters and I stood on a sidewalk on a winter evening with cars rushing in all directions along South Street and up and down the Arborway. Horns blared and streetcars clanged. Red lights turned green, and others did the opposite. In the middle of it was a cop directing traffic in the growing dark, with a whistle in his mouth and white gloves on. It was him that my mother and my aunts, Maureen and Dee, were watching. He was a pal of my Uncle Bill, the cop. Somewhere he had noticed my Aunt Dee, the youngest sister in the family, and expressed an interest in meeting her. Back then, I accepted everything as it happened. Now I wonder if he knew he was under scrutiny. I don't recall that he looked our way, but a car stalled, and with just the use of one white-gloved hand, he pushed it to the curb. "Just one hand," my mother and aunts exclaimed. Dee, as it turned out, married another guy. 20, 30 years later, cruising the Hudson Piers, I'd see guys posed under street lamps in moonlight reflected off the river, and I'd remember that young cop and the show he put on for my aunt. I think I was no more than four, probably a bit less than. I was brushed by the dark. My parents brought home my brother Larry. I'd never seen a baby close up. I stared at Larry in his bassinet with his clenched fists and red face as he cried and cried. Then he went back to the hospital and never returned. He died of a stomach blockage and was buried in a small white coffin. I heard adults talking about this. I didn't cry. It's a gift of childhood that kids don't understand any of this. My mother sat in the kitchen with photographs and postcards arranged face up in front of her and cried. She never acted again. Tears will move me, even my own. Our neighborhood was near the well-to-do Arborway, where the houses look down on you from tall, sloping lawns. The Arboretum was a wood, a park, a wonder with hills and trees as far as your eye could see, if you were real small. It was owned by Harvard and devoted to the study of fauna, but open to the public. Adults had to take you across wide streets to reach it, but once there, rabbits scurried across paths, jays screamed, and in the spring and fall, ponds would be covered with ducks and geese. In winter, big kids would skate. Adjoining the park was a chapel with cloistered nuns, and you could hear them all praying, sometimes singing. A kid with both his grandmothers was very lucky, and I had both of mine. One day, my mother, along with her mother and aunt, took me to the Arboretum. They sat on a bench near the roadway. I think this was just after Larry's death. They spoke to my mother in whispers. I was allowed to wander, but not too far. A pond with lily pads and cattails was nearby. I stood on the bank, looking down, and eyes stared back at me. Breeze-rippled water made a pale face below seem to move, and I ran back to the bench with a babble tail of eyes. The three women arose. I went first and pointed. My mother gasped. Her mother and aunt stepped between the water and us. These thin, white-haired women had been born and raised in the bleak Aran Islands when Gaelic was the first language and life was thin and tough. "A calf," said one. "Poor dear," said the other. "How did it get here?" my mother asked, holding me tight. My grandmother looked up. All eyes followed hers. She was staring at the Harvard labs at the top of the hill. I have a snatch of memory of my aunt and grandmother talking to an Irish cop on the street, with much gesturing of heads in the direction of the building and the pond. He nodded and set off to do who knows what. As that went on, my mother held me, talking to me. "That poor animal that drowned, I saw myself in his eyes. He was like a child. You should never have to see something like that. We'll make all of that go away." She was my world. But she told the story, my story really, of the drowned calf and my fright to friends and relatives. She wrote a poem that used the incident and a play in which a woman says to her child, I don't want you to wake up in unfamiliar houses and strange beds full of coats and not know where you are just because your father dragged me to a party and I had no one to take care of you. You won't see familiar faces distorted with anger or fear leaning over you in the dark and won't have to be afraid because there's a bitter smell on someone's breath. You don't understand now, but you will. I want you to have a childhood without terror. I want you to be safe. I remember my mother talking about the cloistered convent and saying, it must be wonderful never to have to go out and see people you don't want to see. My father said, I don't think you'd like it. They don't talk either. And they both laughed. Some years after Fordham Court, when I was 11 or 12, I revisited the old neighborhood for the first time. One Saturday in fall, spontaneously and unsupervised, a bunch of friends and I walked from Codman Square in Dorchester, down Washington Street, and across Blue Hill Avenue to grubby Franklin Park. We went through the zoo and into threadbare woods as dark and wide as Sherwood Forest to a bunch of city kids. To my surprise, we emerged an hour or more later onto the Arborway, and I caught sight of Fordham Court. We went into the Arboretum. The Harvard labs looked down from the hill. No eyes looked at us from the water. But a bunch of guys, 14 or 15 years old, stood on the other side of the pond. A single mallard, unable to fly, hid in the reeds. They poked it with sticks, chased it out. One kid had a BB gun and raked the bird with shot. They got it ashore and cut its head off. Blood spurted. When it was done, a kid held the duck by the tips of its wings. They knew we were intruders and stared at us. They were big and scary. It was getting late in the afternoon. We split for home. I knew better than to tell my parents where I'd been, but the image of the headless bird with its wings spread replaced the eyes looking up from the bottom of the pond, and this story was mine, not my mother's. In Fordham Court, the bedroom windows looked out on the courtyard, in the windows of the other wing of the building. Not much to see, but outside the kitchen and the living room was a world of wonders, an anachronism then, a lost world now. The alley below me was lined with a tall, blank-faced wooden fence. When TV appeared and I saw our gang comedies from the 20s, there was always a big board fence at the back of the set. It evoked the everyday life in the early 20th century city that I'd seen out that window. Beyond the fence were backyards, one of which contained a chicken coop, complete with a strutting white rooster. To the right was open ground and an embankment where railroad tracks bore long, fascinating freights and flashing, streamlined passenger trains inbound to Boston or outbound to New York. And between the houses and the trains was a trolley yard full of yellow-orange cars and a barn for the Hood milk horses, old tired nags as I'd seen them see them now, but gigantic, scary beasts as I watched them one after another be hitched to wagons in the morning and unhitched at nightfall. A leftover effect of the Depression, the war, and a conservative city's reluctance to change was the presence of horses. This was my father's old neighborhood, and he had hung around barns and livery stables as a kid. I remember him taking me into downtown Boston and the Faneuil Hall Market. Before the highways made that impossible, farmers came into the city on horse-drawn wagons, great, tired animals would breathe steam and sometimes make sparks when they smacked their hooves down on the cobblestones. My father taught me stuff he believed a city kid had to know. Not to walk close behind or before them, how to pat the nose with a downward stroke, going with an animal's hair. My father had served in the Army Air Corps in Italy, had flown 30 missions. He sometimes wore a leather flight jacket. He had a crew cut, and so did I. He took me to the bright, loud barbershop, guys talking, boxing, razors buzzing, and the long mirror reflecting the barbers and the men in their chairs. My jacket got removed, and I was wrapped in a striped cape, lifted way in the air and down into a raised seat on top of the barber chair. Up above the mirror was a radio broadcasting the big serial. An unending kids' action-adventure show that came on late in the afternoon. I was scared by the shooting and whooping. "Engines," someone shouted. "Get inside the house." I thought he said engines, and imagined trains off the tracks and rampaging through the streets with their horns whooping. I started to cry. The barber smiled and said, "Don't pay no attention, kid. They're full of baloney. Someone turn that thing off." I cried, but stayed still and let him cut my hair. He gave me a lollipop when we were finished, but my father wasn't happy with me. I had embarrassed him. About that time, I went to kindergarten and was allowed to go out by myself. Was made to, I think. I couldn't cross any streets, was the rule. I stayed on my block. A girl in my class lived next door, and I sometimes played with her. I fell in with Joey, a tough kid whose mother didn't believe in kindergarten. I saw stuff, streetcars, the square, old-fashioned kind, ran on South Street. Dogs roamed free. One got run over, yelping and rolling on the road. I don't think I quite understood what had happened. Because the stables were there, and because this was still not the modern world, a couple of the kids in the neighborhood had pet goats that stayed in the stable. They had goat carts they used to drive on the sidewalks and empty lots. My mother was on the phone one day, so I only heard part of the conversation and only understood it years later. Her mother told her that the Hood's milk barn in her neighborhood had burned down. Horses and all the Shetland ponies that pulled the ice cream carts had died. Homeless horse flies were all over the place. A bit later, just before we moved away from that neighborhood, my father took me down to the stable behind the house. He met a guy he knew, and we watched those poor old nags being led onto trucks. My father told me they were going off to a farm where they'd be happy. He and his friend were talking far above my head. Everyone says Hood decided to go over to milk trucks after that fire, the guy said, but Hood was converting anyway. I heard that the fire was for insurance. And I saw one of the kids with a goat cart, a big kid, maybe 10, crying because with the barn shut down, he couldn't keep the goat. Around then, I was told we were going to move, and I don't remember being upset. Years ago, I found a story about Fordham Court and me that I probably wrote when I was around 21. By then, I'd left Boston and was in a college writing class. I can't say if the visit actually happened or how much of it was invented. It comes from a time when I was losing myself in the slippery mix of speed and booze, but it was written just a few years after the event it recounts, with all the intensity and truth of a dream. The night and the day. Tracks on a Boston street in a drizzly evening catch the light of the streetcar coming towards the Chevy with me in the back seat. It clangs its bell, and the driver drifts to the left to let the trolley pass. The driver's called Bro. I never met him before, and he doesn't talk. Next to him is a guy I've known for a couple of years. He's called Ty and a bunch of other names. He got busted, and for a while, we hadn't seen each other. Now he's back in my life. I work part-time at the library, the same as when he first saw me. Out of nowhere, he walks in and says he's called Tony now, which is stupid. He's not Italian. The two of us are Irish, and everyone says we look like twins. Tony's not talking much. I met him in Copley Square that evening because there's someone he wants me to meet, and he gives me a down, a second all, to stop my being jumpy. As Ty, he kind of seemed like an imaginary friend, and in lots of ways he still does. I'm 18 and in college. My family has moved from Boston to Long Island in New York. There are relatives, there are family friends, people I know, but I'm kind of lost and broke and at loose ends, living in a dorm with strangers, and the cops are down on cruising. Bro drives us past a big brick Catholic church, and something that feels like a memory tickles the back of my brain. Makes my head loll around. I know this place, I say. Jamaica Plain. I lived here. No one says anything. It's dark, but stores are still open. Windows lighted. Stuff looks familiar, 13, 14 years after I moved away. It's like deja vu. We pass a barbershop that looks familiar, and I remember the radio and the high shelf and the giant trains running wild in the street. I connect the incident to my father losing interest in me. Bro spots a parking space, and we slide into it. Tony says, "We're here." And we both get out. Bro stays behind. We're in front of an apartment house built around an oval court. It's all as familiar as a dream. "I used to live in this building," he said, "Fordham Court." I said, Tony sticks another second all in my mouth, and I swallow it. Instead of going into the court, though, through the front door, Tony leads me around the side of the building and down an alley. Ed wants us to use the tradesman's interest because we trade, Tony said. I recognize the high wooden fence on one side, the doors on the other. "Who's Ed?" I manage to say. Speaking's not easy. "How does he know me?" "He's a queer. I met a month or so ago. He's okay, but I got a girl up in Revere that I'm seeing." "A girl?" He'd shown me gay life in Boston, at least the kind that involved kids, when we were 16. He rings the bell. A head pops out a third floor window, then disappears, and the buzzer sounds. We're going up these wooden stairs, and I can remember hearing the milkman come up them early in the morning with the glass bottles clanking in the metal carrier, and it occurs to me to ask, "What did you tell this guy?" I said if he liked me, he was going to love you. And we're on the third floor, which I seem to remember is where I lived. The door opens into a kitchen. I'm kind of confused and dizzy. But I see this guy, nice enough, tall, losing his hair, in a shirt and tie. He's staring at me, and Tony is introducing us. "What is this, your brother?" Ed says. Like I said, back then, when Ty and I first knew each other, everyone thought we looked alike. Tony says something. Ed slips him some bills. And the next thing I know, Tony's gone, and Ed asks me if I'd like something to eat or drink. And I shake my head, and he's got his hands on me. But it's okay, and I'm kind of not there. Later, I have no clothes, and he gets me off, and then it's another time, and he's riding me, which I don't let guys do. But I'm not connected enough to say stop. Then it's light through the front window, overlooking the courtyard. Ed's asleep, and my head hurts, and my ass, and I pass out again. When I wake up, the light is brighter. I can hear Ed taking a shower. I'm still high. My clothes aren't around. I get up, walk down this little hall that I remember is gigantic. It leads to the living room, and lights coming in the windows. I go over and look out. It's morning, and guys are painting a wooden house down the street. Nobody is raising chickens in the backyard. The train line is still there on its embankment. They have a garage now, where the stable was. The streetcar yards are there, but with newer cars, not as much track as I remember. Something moves at the corner of my eye, and I glance into the kitchen. My mother, looking like she did when I was a little kid, sits at the table with her sisters and her aunt, and both my grandmothers. They're playing with cards, and on closer look, there are actually photos of people in the family. I see one of my father in velvet knee breeches when he was maybe 10, and one of me standing in the living room as I am. None of them look my way. Putting on a show for the neighbors, Ed asks, and I realize I'm right in front of a window. My clothes are in the bathroom. He leads me there. I'm driving downtown. Can I give you a lift? I nod and shove my clothes on. There's money in my jacket pocket. I walk back to the kitchen. The women don't look up. Ed takes my arm and says, "We're going out the other way." On the stairs, I tell him, "I used to live here. So you said last night." I wonder what else I said, and if it's why he doesn't want me to disturb the women in the kitchen. Over the years and many readings, that story always leaves me with the sensation I'm on the other side of an iron gate with only a glimpse of the land of giants.
Thank you. That was about, 20 minutes shorter than or 15 minutes shorter than I thought it was going to be. You caught me off guard.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry.
I have no way of measuring. I can never tell how long these things are going to...
So it seems, roughly, I would say 2.5 minutes per page is a reasonable guesstimate.
Well, it was 18 pages, so...
So it should have been 36 minutes, but yes. Instead it was about 25.
Well, I guess because I read fast.
Huh? Well, exactly, and I asked you not to. But, no, I mean, it was a good reading. It was a good reading. And it's an interesting story. But I have noticed the last few times that you've been on the show, and also what I've read of your most recent publications, there's always been a very strong element of autobiography. Yes. In your stories. But these are getting less and less removed from speculative fiction as we go on.
Well, the first part certainly of this is reminiscence.
Yeah, point the mic. No, don't close in, but point it more at you.
Like so. The first part of the story is reminiscence. That is, as I remember it. And the second part, it really is a manuscript that was left over from the writing class that I took at Hofstra in, like, the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something like it happened.
Yeah.
And that I did go back to Fordham Court, but I'm not sure.
Now, this is going to be published in Interfictions?
It's going to be published in Interfictions, yes.
Which is an online magazine.
It's an online magazine.
It has been a print pub, but this is the online version.
Was it ever print? It was a couple of books.
Yes.
Okay, but never. That's I don't print. Think it was. It wasn't a print magazine.
No, it was a serial anthology, meaning there was the first issue, the second issue, and all that. And so I consider those serial books when you expect another one to come out. It's like having an issue.
I suppose, yeah.
When you had the Orbit books edited by Damon Knight, those Orbit 1, Orbit 2, Orbit 3.
Right, but the thing with Interfictions... the interstitial writing is that it combines. It combines mm-hmm. different formats, it combines different forms. And the reason.
That's the exact reason right. for its existence, and we should describe that.
I'm not sure I can. One of the things about
I've had so many people on this show talking about it.
Well, that is your misfortune. When they were first bringing out the first of the Interfiction forks, Delia Sherman, whose project this is.
When it was first announced, Delia came on the air, brought some guy, didn't tell me about it, something named Carlos Hernandez, you know. And
yeah, well.
You know, he's such a great talent and such a nice person. So, you know, I ain't got nothing against it.
No, but she told me that I was an interstitial writer, and
yes, but you know, interstitial is a term. Now I have heard it described as a medical term, and I have since looked into it a little further because I was rereading Stephen Hawking's Thingy of Time, and the word comes up there, and its meaning, according to what I have researched, has more to do with atomic structure than, in fact, just medicine, where there are points in, you know, when you look at an atom, there's space between the proton and the neutron and the electron and all the trony parts of the atom, and those are interstitial. They're in between. And in medicine, it's like it's not an organ, it's not a vein. Again, it's just meat. It's interstitial. We don't have an exact definition for
it. Right. It's something that doesn't have a name, basically.
Yeah. It's in between these things. It is of them all. And none of them at the same time. It's very much a part of quantum physics.
Well,
that's why
in some ways, right. In some ways, I suppose you're right. I am moving closer to just straight fiction rather than.
I wouldn't say straight fiction.
Plain fiction.
I'm sorry. Couldn't leave that alone.
A dirty mind is a joy for
Now, excuse me. There's nothing dirty.
Oh, joking. But I don't... The second part of the story, the part that was the manuscript, my mother, bless her, saved everything that I had written when I was in college. And it was in some of which I really wish she had never seen, but I'm sure she read it. And they were in boxes down in the cellar of the house in Newton, Massachusetts, where they had moved. And when I began writing short stories, I pilfered from those boxes. And these were stories I had written when I was 19, 20, 21. And it was like collaborating with a bright but really disturbed kid. And there was a lot of mystery in this stuff. Some of it I didn't remember having written. And some of it, like the story I used here, was so accurate and so evocative that I did get the feeling and did begin to remember that had actually happened, that I had gone back and been in the same apartment where I had lived as a little kid. And
that must have a very, interstitial feeling. I don't know what the word is.
I don't know what it is either, but I will say this.
It's a deja something.
I will say this. I got those stories, like in, say, all of those stories I took from my mother's cellar, and it was like 1990. So it was like, you know, some years ago, and I haven't used this thing in all of that time because I said there is no place for this. But then, thanks to interstitiality, there was a place for it, and that is where I don't know about. You think there are other stories in which I am writing a more autobiographical?
Well, the last time that you were here, you read, I think it was two pastiches. Having to do with Oh, I think your father in a back room with some politicians.
My grandfather.
Your grandfather. Okay.
My grandfather. Yes, my grandfather. Well, that was autobiographical. My grandfather.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, my grandfather took me, although he was not. He was, I think, an imaginary creature. But yes, that's right. He took me. It was 1948. I was 4 years old, and it was the presidential election, Harry Truman against Tom Dewey, and he took me to a poll.
Dewey wins.
Dewey did win, yes, of course, but in that alternate world that I, thank God, I don't live in.
We've got the newspaper to prove it.
Well, we have, yes. But anyway, he took me to the polling place, and he got a ballot and showed me how to write my name on it, and I voted for Harry Truman. And all of the old micks running, you're doing the right thing, Mike, teaching him to, you know. So, yes, that is also autobiographical, but I think there is a bit of magic in it, or at least fantasy in it.
Mm-hmm.
His fantasy rather than, you know, mine. But
people talk about fantasy literature, they usually mean, probably the term would be high fantasy. How would you term, like, you know, Tolkien?
Well, Tolkien is...
It's not just fantasy, it's...
Well, he's done something
high
else.
High fantasy.
I guess you could call it high fantasy. I mean, what he's doing is playing around with mythos, and, mm-hmm. I mean, he's obviously very influenced by Wagner,
No, they are both influenced by the same source material.
No. As a person, a young person of his time, Wagner was to him what the Rolling Stones and the Beatles were to people of the 60s and 70s. It was an impossible part of the culture for young people to escape. Nor would they have wanted to.
Right. I mean, I love Wagner.
I can't stand him, but...
I'm a big fan of the Ring Cycle.
Right, but that...
I should rephrase that. I'm not a Wagnerian fan. I'm a fan of the Ring Cycle, specifically.
Well,
I couldn't...
Anyway,
the thing
about Tolkien... Oh my,
yeah.
Yes, that's high fantasy. Low fantasy, I suppose, would be folk tales. Something... The Brothers Grimm, I mean, it's pretty Baudelaireized, but, you know, it's...
Well, it depends.
It's farm.
There have been better translations of late.
Well, there have been different translations. The high fantasy, I suppose, is Perrault. But fantasy in and of itself, urban fantasy, urban fantasy is fantasy.
Well, for example, your book. The one from Aqueduct.
The Queen, the Cambion, and Seven Others.
Thank you. That's a little less autobiographical than this.
Yes, I would say that's true. Yeah.
And so these have, like, I mean, it's so difficult to take this chart of this. I mean, it's not even necessarily a genre. It's this scope of literature that one cannot, should not pin down. But a lot of what you have written is definitely without question. You read it and you say, "Well, that's genre." You know, the god Mercury just showed up. That's genre. And in some, the magic that occurs is really the recollection of a young person and how they interpreted something at the time it occurred, which is a magic.
Yes.
But it's not a... It is a fantastic magic. I don't know what I'm trying to say here.
Well, fantasy is such a loose term, And there are so many things that, you know, can be described as fantasy.
I mean, you can say all science fiction is a subgenre of fantasy. Because fantasy, yeah.
And fantasy got there first. Basically, but...
There are people who claim that, you know.
Well, you know...
Not Lester Del Rey, the aforementioned, but other there are other people who say this fantasy genre exists and science fiction grew out of that.
Well, definitely fantasy, as we interpret it, is first, and science fiction is generally quite recent as these things go. I mean, the 19th century is really when it becomes an organized format. You get Jules Verne and you get H.G. Wells and that kind
and
of thing.
And Mary Shelley person, yeah.
Mary Shelley is sort of like before the kickoff kind of thing.
She's the prequel.
She is, or, you know... the trip to the moon there by what's his name with the long with the big nose,
Cyrano
de Bergerac, right? All of those, the Republic
Journey
of,
to the Moon,
whatever it's called.
Yeah,
the Republic of Plato. I suppose you could twist that around and turn that into science
fiction.
Absolutely,
yeah. Aristophanes' piece, you know,
right?
Going to the moon on a snail,
right?
That's all. Within, and in the case of Cyrano, there's an argument, a bad argument, but an argument to be made that that's hard science fiction because he was dealing with what exponents of the science of the day. In order to breathe oxygen, he fills a pig bladder with... is it sun rays or something like that?
I forget.
He finds a way to get oxygen into what would later become a balloon and carries that with him for breathing. He was actually thinking about that.
Right. The Cyrano that we have is the one from the play.
From Rostand, yeah.
Rostand from the late 19th century.
But there was a real person.
There certainly was, yes. And he did... write the trip to the moon. Well, that is very nice. It's kind of like readings at KGB, you know, where you get the sirens out in the street.
And yeah, exactly.
The full New York experience.
Oh, yeah, but the best thing is that very often coming off the BQE and coming up Atlantic Avenue, you get motorcycle clubs. And that's when this place rocks. And I mean rocks.
Really shakes the joint.
It really shakes the joint. Interestingly, downstairs in the Commons Cafe, you don't hear it anywhere near as much as you do up here on the third floor, with these reverberating wall windows.
We're not afraid to let in the outside world here at WBAI. We welcome the city of New York.
So you say. There are those at WBAI that are very different, Rick. But
that, I think, almost goes without saying. Everybody at WBAI is quite different. Yeah, and
indeed, and that is my love for the limited diversity of what we have on the air. And let me remind people, you can pledge. I took a look while you were reading. The last pledge seemed to have come in at about, a little before 11 p.m. So
we have not, and I have not inspired them to give money.
People might have actually pledged on the website.
You're being very kind. I'm afraid I've failed here.
But we can say to people that if you care to pledge so that this room gets a little bit more. We've got this. I don't know what this is. It's like a silk thing behind. That's our soundproofing. It's not even sound absorbent. It's a flag.
It's the flag of WBAI.
Yeah, I put it up a month ago on Facebook. I put a nice picture of you in there just now, by the way.
Oh, did
on
you?
On Instagram. What? Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, Lester. Hey, Lester. How are you? So nice to see you.
Yeah, he was able to get in on the code I gave him. I wasn't able to. I don't know.
Well, that says something.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. It really does.
I don't know what it says, but it says something.
It likes Lister. And what entity wouldn't?
The building loves you, Lester.
Yeah, but more so than CCNY. Well, the guards at CCNY, that's the one thing I'll miss, is that I thought that the security staff...
Well, security
at City College. I thought they were great.
Well, it's one of the things, if you're working at a university, I mean, it does know.
And again, we have to tell listeners you used to work at NYU.
I worked at NYU. You don't yell and scream at the students.
You're
polite. They were
more than polite. They were nice. They were helpful.
Very nice, yeah.
No,
it was. I liked it. I liked it to be in the cellar of.
Well, it was the building. It was the labyrinth itself, and the fact that
the Minotaur was in the next room.
They were. I mean, we were renting a room in somebody else's radio station,
and they were not happy.
And they were not happy about that. And
I don't blame them.
I don't blame them either. But I was displeased that somebody would be playing their. Beat music so loud that they were in their soundproof room, there was a soundproof room between, and there was our soundproof room, and they would leave their door open, and they would just bang out there, and they didn't care. And if you asked them to tone it down, they made it louder.
Well,
there were a couple of people there that were nice, and I'm told by so many people, oh, I had no problems. Well, they were there during the day. Late at night, when friends of alumni were the people doing the shows there, they were not as spiffy.
Well, it was
what it was.
It was what it was. Yeah.
But so this is we were counting, right? This is my sixth. Official WBAI. There have been several unofficial WBAI.
Oh, God. Radio station. A wandering radio station.
A thing of shreds and patches.
You betcha.
And yeah, absolutely. I not only like Wagner, I like Gilbert and Sullivan.
I like Gilbert and Sullivan. I'm ashamed, but yes, I can't help it.
Yeah, I was very, very tempted to buy tickets to Symphony Space to see the English National Opera production of Pirates of Penzance directed by Mike Leigh.
Yes, yeah.
And until I saw the reviews. Because what Mike Leigh did with the Mikado in Topsy-Turvy is just wondrous.
He took a couple of the lesser-known operas, little scenes from Princess Ida and the Sorcerer. Also,
yeah.
It was very nicely done.
Yeah, and it was. And I read the British reviews, The Guardian and The Mail, and those of his production of Pirates. And I thought, no, I'm going to give this a pass. Not a question about the singing. But the sets are just sort of like, projections of Queen Victoria and all that. It didn't have that same feeling of what Gilbert might have done.
Well, I really wonder if it isn't a problem with the Savoy operas that they really can only be done one way.
I did a Ruddigore myself, but go on.
Right. Part of it's partly necessary if something is a great work that it can be interpreted in many different ways and mm-hmm. be performed in many different ways.
Yeah.
And as time goes on, Gilbert and Sullivan's stuff doesn't quite make that leap.
Some of it doesn't. I mean, I did not care for, say, Jonathan Miller's rendition of Mikado with people.
I thought it was fine.
I thought, well, my biggest problem was actually with the choreography, which the bad Charlestons. They were trying to transfer it to the 1920s.
Yes, I saw it.
And I thought the idea was good. And Eric Idle was fine in his role. He was better than Groucho Marx was, just in saying a lot.
Well, by that standard, yes.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, Coco, he's that kind of a character, right. You know, where you have whatever comedian you have on hand and you throw them in. It's like... the jailer in Fledermaus, you know, I saw
some out of work stand-up comedian. Yes.
I went to New York City Opera, and Dom DeLuise.
Yes, was
and Rudy Giuliani was
Julie Rudiani. I remember.
Yes, you remember her.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, it is. Oh my God, we're about out of time, aren't we?
I believe we are.
You're getting up. You're actually 2 minutes.
My coat, which is because it's cold in here.
Oh, you did bring it.
I brought it in here.
Oh, well, we have 2 minutes left, yes. So we'll get back to the microphone, will you, Rick? Listener, burn, baby, burn. With a title like that, you know the room's going to be hot.
He's going to burn the thing down.
That's why he takes off his clothes when the show starts.
There he goes.
You're facing the wrong way, Rick.
I'm facing the wrong way.
Yes,
so you want me to talk into the mic, and yet you want me to watch him.
No, you wanted to watch him. Let's see. What announcements do I have to make? I have no announcements to make because there's no KGB next week.
That's right.
There's or is it?
No, it isn't.
Well, what day? Oh, it's only June 3rd.
It is only June 3rd. Yes,
go or 4th by now.
Go back to sleep.
But if you, two days ago, we had a very nice New York Review of Science Fiction reading.
We did indeed, down in the cellar.
Down in the cellar, probably our farewell to the former Soho Gallery of Digital Art. We had some good times there in the upper venue. But we are now in the building where the readings occur. And again, let me remind listeners, go to livestream.com.
And see the results.
Yeah, absolutely. You do a search on NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction, and you can actually see the beta episodes of what will be going on. Terrence Taylor did a fabulous job.
Yep.
He really did. It looks like a professional TV show because he knows what the F he is doing. We don't have the list of words here, so I think that would be number two.
Would you care to run through the list of words?
In 5 minutes, yes. what are your books in print?
Available.
Richard Bowes, B-O-W-E-S.
Richard Bowes, D-O-W-E-S. In print is... are my novel Dust Devil on a Quiet Street.
Mm. Correct. Wonderful. I mean, the fact that there's a hole in the city opens it is only the beginning. It's a really fun mix-up collection. I won't say mash-up, but...
We have that. There is a... pardon me. I'm not going to be able to speak.
Well, we're about done. In fact, we are done, but... let's see. People can go to rickbowes.com, RickBowes.com, and that's Rick's website. And you can see all the various different things there. And you can also simply Google up Richard Bowes, because the books are under that name. And be able to find out what's in print there. So, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
We will be back next week with Lev A.C. Rosen as our guest. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way. And have a wonderful morning. Be good to each other.
Tune to Radio Station WBAI 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org. Couple of minutes after 3 o'clock. Yeah.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a real man. And you're going to have to keep on saying that.
Great show this morning, Jim Freund. We'll be back next week. List Alive. From Ottawa, Canada to Do or Die, Bed-Stuy. Bird, baby, bird.
Red, white, the blue, I'm not Captain America. Too black, too strong. Causing mass hysteria. Trying to reach my freedom of speech. Expressing myself, torching the symbol.